Did. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to this oral argument, but we have a special welcome for Iowa Grant High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We also have with us as students from the Senate Scholar Program. Would they stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The scholars have been in the Capitol for, I think, a week now, right? And they have visited with the branches of government and government entities. And we're delighted to welcome you. We've had you at several oral arguments and other presentations. The high school students are here with the program called Court with Class. In this program, we invite students from across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if they do, they're given the briefs in the case that they'll hear, and they may engage in outside activities relating to the case. They come for an oral argument. And after the second case, they meet with a justice of this court to discuss the procedural aspects of hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issue involved. If any of you is not familiar with the case and would like a summary, just raise your hand and we'll give you a summary of this case. It's easier to hear and understand the case if you know something about the facts and legal issue involved. Anyone want a summary? Okay, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you're going to meet today after the second case. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case 05AP2852, Chad Novell versus Migliaccio. Is that how we pronounce the name? Pardon me? You are representing the defendants here?
I am.
Good. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Joseph Welsenbach. My son, my associate, Jeffrey Welsenbach, is along with me here today, and we represent Mr. and Mrs. Migliaccio, who are the defendants in the lower court action and the petitioners before this court. Now, this case arises out of six claims for misrepresentation that were lodged in the circuit court in regard to a home sale. The claim in the circuit court and here as well is that the seller, my clients, Mr. and Mrs. Migliaccio, misstated the condition of their home, to wit, the condition of their basement. The trial court, Judge Michael Gooley, dismissed each and every one of these claims on the basis that there was no reasonable reliance in this case as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals upheld all the dismissals with the exception of one, and that was the dismissal relating to Section 100.18, what I call the fraud statute. The Court of Appeals held that there was no reasonable reliance for any of the common law claims, but said that reasonable reliance is not an element of 100.18 action. Now, we sought review of that, we being the Migliaccios, petitioned to review that decision. The plaintiff, in this case, Mr. Novell, has not sought review of any of the Court of Appeals' decision. So our position is that the law of the case in this case before this court today is that reliance was unreasonable. that there's no question before this court that the reliance was unreasonable. That's
well, if
the law
we decide that if we decide that the reliance is not relevant, then the law of the case issue drops out, isn't it?
That would be true if you decide it's not relevant. Okay. All right.
Counsel, I have a question. As I read the Court of Appeals decision, not only did they talk about justifiable reliance, but they found that there was a genuine issue of material fact, and that that was part, at least, of the reason why they were reversing the trial court. What's your position in regard to that issue? As you know, that's extremely important on summary judgment.
Sure. The Court of Appeals, as I understand the Migliaccio decision, upheld the finding that there was unreasonable reliance, sent the case back under the 100.18 because there was an issue as to whether or not there was a causal connection, whether or not the Mr. Novum acted in absence of the misrepresentation or not, and that those would be issues of fact under 100.18. My reading of the Court of Appeals decision indicates to me that they're not contemplating, or that it didn't, that the Court of Appeals decision did not contemplate that there would be an issue as to whether or not reasonable reliance was an element of the plaintiff's claim, and that therefore that would not be an issue of fact. However, if I can go on, as we know, not only in the Migliaccio case and the Malczewski case, but in the case decided here, the KNS, what I call KNS 2 case, the court said, well, even though reasonable reliance is not an element, it's still something the jury can consider. That there, and my reading is that reliance is an element, if this makes any sense, that reliance is an element of 100.18, and that it's a gray area to me whether or not this court is saying that reasonable reliance is a necessary element of proof by the plaintiff. Somewhere in these cases, reasonable reliance enters into a 100.18 action. It just has to.
Where I'm having some trouble with this case is along these lines. You've got that Malczewski decision, and Malczewski seems to talk, as does this case, about the fact that because in this case, the Court of Appeals quotes that case. It seems to talk in terms of the fact that there are situations in which justifiable reliance is indeed or could be an element. And they talk specifically about situations where the decision is being made as a matter of law. And I guess what I'm getting to is we could conceivably come to a conclusion here that justifiable reliance is an element, not a statutory element, but an element that's there in cases of this nature, and yet conclude that there are genuine issues of material fact. And what I'm trying to get to in my questions is, how do you respond to that? Do you see this as a situation where this should be decided as a matter of law, or do you see that this is a situation where indeed we could agree with you on justifiable reliance but have to send it back because there are genuine issues of material fact?
Well, I think this, that if you decide, as I think the Malczewski case is kind of indicating, if you decide that reasonable reliance should be an element of a claim for false advertising that can be decided as a matter of law, as the Malczewski case said in that footnote, that's exactly what they said. Then, if you decide that, my position is that unreasonable reliance has been decided in this case as a matter of law by Judge Gooley, upheld by the Court of Appeals, and not sought a review of that issue.
Yep.
Has not been made. Yes, Justice.
Yep, Counsel, I'm trying to follow your argument. And as I understand where the reliance argument comes in, and maybe I'm misreading the cases, but as I see Malczewski and KNS, this goes towards the third element, And in K&S, the third element is described as the representation caused the plaintiff a pecuniary loss. In Malzewski, the third element was described as the plaintiff sustained a pecuniary loss because of the advertisement, announcement, statement, or representation, citing Keatsworth. So as I understand the whole discussion of reliance, it really goes towards the question of causation and whether or not the misrepresentation caused the loss on the part of the plaintiff.
True.
So if it goes towards the issue of causation, I'm not sure that we're walking down the right track in terms of trying to define that in terms of reasonable reliance, particularly in view of the language in both cases that say it's not an element.
Well, the element is, number one, the test, and I'm reading from the jury instruction, and this is based on case law. The test, number one, is would the plaintiff have acted in the absence of the representation? Okay. Number two, was it a material inducement? Number three, it must be a significant factor. And what I go back to is I look at the statute. If we look at the statute, the penalty section says basically, let me find it here, that if any person suffers a loss, a pecuniary loss, and they use the word because of a violation. Now let's, in my opinion, we should analyze this with some common sense, meaning let's use the example that Judge Kessler used in the dissent in the Malzewski case. If I am told that I can buy a cape and it'll fly, now, does that allow, and it doesn't fly, under the theory I think Mr. Kuss or the plaintiff has here, they can bring an action under 100.18. Now, clearly, there can't be any reliance there. You sell me a car that's going to get 500 miles
to the gallon. But didn't you just answer your own argument? You said clearly there can't be any reliance.
True.
The focus is on reliance.
Right.
But you're adding a word to that now in terms of reasonable reliance. And if the issue is causation, that's why I'm trying to focus on the element itself.
Okay. I'm saying this, that when we talk about causation, we in effect are talking about reliance. We're talking, did this person rely? Did he rely on the cape thing, for instance? Was that a cause of his damage? To not read into the statute an element of reliance, which I think the K&S Supreme Court decision does, seems to be unworkable. It leads to absurd results.
I understand your argument, but then my question, the reason I'm pressing you on it, is then, If reliance is really what we're getting at when we're talking about causation, isn't that a question of fact?
Well, it's a question of fact in the typical situation. Here, we've had two decisions saying that the reliance has been unreasonable. That, to me, is the law of the case because they're not questioning. They're not raising that as an issue in this case. They're not saying there's an issue of fact as to whether our reliance was reasonable or unreasonable. I'm saying even if they can prove a case without proving their own reasonable reliance, that at the very least we have a defense that it's unreasonable, which has been decided here. If they wanted to question the unreasonableness or raise a question of fact as to that, I think then there should have been a petition to this court to review that. There isn't that issue, as far as I'm concerned, and I certainly can be wrong, is not before this court. If we go back to Judge Gooley, he's going to say, I already found this to be unreasonable reliance.
Well, your position, if I understand it, is that for under 100.18, is it the plaintiff's burden of proof to show that the reliance on the alleged misrepresentation is reasonable? Is that your position?
That's our position.
That's okay. Yeah. What I hear and what I see in the cases is a concept that maybe that's not the proof of the plaintiff, but it comes under causation. And I'm going to state this a little differently and maybe see if that works. Reliance is perhaps an objective test. Would it be reasonable for a reasonable person, you know, to have relied on this? That's that Superman footnote, you know. Sure. Come on. Most people who would reasonable people of reasonable sense would know that somebody who sells a cape and says, if you wear the cape, you can fly, would know that if they buy the cape and they wear it, they are not going to fly unless they buy a ticket and go on a True. Commercial plane, True. Right? Okay. Mm. So that's reasonable. That's the reasonable person objective standard. That may be in an ordinary common law misrepresentation case, right?
True.
Okay. Maybe the reliance in this case is subjective. Did this particular guy rely on the misrepresentation? And then you say, you know, we don't know. We can't open up his head and say, did he rely, didn't he rely? So to determine subjectively, did he rely, you look and see, you know, is it reasonable for people to rely? Even though maybe most people wouldn't rely, this is in the ballpark. He's a little more gullible than most people, okay? So he's in the ballpark. And that's the test. And that's what it means on causation. And that if you, the defendant, wants to win on a summary judgment, then what you have to prove, or what your affidavits and cetera have to say, is that as a matter of law, nobody under these circumstances would rely. As a matter of law, you just can't rely on this. That's a Superman, too. Can't rely on this, and that's the case. So it's a matter of how you set all this up. So how do you set it up? And what's the matter with my hypothesis of objective and subjective?
Well, number one, when this case was started, the complaint itself, which I unfortunately didn't put in the appendix, the complaint of the plaintiff for a violation of Section 100.18 mm-hmm. Indicates in paragraph 23 that he justifiably relied on these misrepresentations. So number one, the plaintiff himself, in commencing this action, recognized, or at least thought, as I think I would have, that justifiable reliance is an element of 100.18. Number two, we can take my point of the Superman cape is obviously that's totally unreasonable for anybody to rely on that. But let's assume someone did. Let's assume it was that you can get 150 miles a gallon from my car if I sell it to you. That may be equally as silly. But what I'm saying is that if we don't put the reasonable reliance element into that 118, there is nothing to prohibit, as foolish as it may seem to start a lawsuit, there's nothing to prohibit that person who buys that cape from suing, starting an action, because his cape wouldn't fly. Now, will a trial court will immediately, obviously, on a motion to dismiss it as being unreasonable reliance. That's what we had here. The trial court reviewed all this and dismissed each claim because it was unreasonably relied on. The Court of Appeals agreed with that. And I don't think we're in a position, I'm hoping we're not in a position where we somehow wind up back in the trial court with a decision saying that lo and behold, this is an issue of fact. because I don't think it's an issue of fact in this case anymore. I think the only issue here is whether or not reliance is an element of misrepresentation under 100.18.
Counsel, the question you pose is whether reliance is an element under 100.18.
Correct.
Does it 100.18 allows for a cause of action to be brought by the state of Wisconsin or private individuals? Do the elements of 100.18 change depending on who's the plaintiff?
Not that I can see.
I would think that's quite odd if we would have as a rule of law that they change because depending on who the plaintiff is. Now, it's not odd to say they change depending on who the defendant is, because if you look at 100.18, and I say this with a smile, towards the very end of this lengthy 100.18, you will see that 12A says this 100.18 doesn't apply to the insurance industry, and that it doesn't apply to real estate brokers or salesperson. So it does make a difference who the defendant is, but it shouldn't make a difference as to the elements of a cause of action as to the plaintiff. My problem is this. First time I came in contact with 100.18 was when I, years ago, was working with the Department of Justice. 100.18, historically, although it provides for a private cause of action, really historically has been a tool used by the Department of Justice to enforce false, misleading, deceptive misrepresentations in advertising. And perhaps that's evidenced by looking at the language of the statute itself. You will see under 11A, that gives authority to the Department of Ag or Consumer Protection. It used to be the Department of Justice years ago that had specific statutory authority to enforce that change later to the Department of Ag. So 11A gives the Department of Ag authority to enforce. 11B talks about a private individual. That's B2. B3 then gives the statute of limitations, which is 3 years, which is different than others. But then when you get to the rest of the statute, except for the exclusions at the very end, it all deals with the department, because the department, in large part, was bringing these causes of action. C1, when the department has reason to believe that a person is in possession, control, of any information, etc. 2, the department in exercising the powers under this subsection. 3, deals with service of any notice by the department. 4, if a person fails to something or another, that's right. I don't see by the, issued by the department. D, the department or the Department of Justice. E, you know, all of this stuff, except for 2, deals with the department enforcing. Are you suggesting that in order for the state of Wisconsin to enforce under 100.18, they're going to have to show reasonable reliance as an element?
On the part of the public?
Well, you just said the elements are the same. And I want to know, when the state of Wisconsin enforces under 100.18, for instance, what are the kinds of things they enforce? Let's look under 3M. 100.18.
Sure.
3M. Closing out sales. If they would just substitute, now I'm looking under 4, substitute property or services. When they come to bring an enforcement action, they're going to have to show not only that the advertising falsely said it was a closing out sale when it wasn't, but that customers relied on it. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Either. So are the elements different for plaintiffs?
I think so. And here's why. Here's why I think that. this statute wasn't just created at one time, as you well know. In 1913, it was passed simply to prohibit advertisements that were misleading or false. That was the original intent. 1945, it was amended to include not only advertisements, but announcements, statements, representations. And it gave the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture power to enjoin violations. Now, if, let's say, a car dealership is advertising something that's false. Now, the Department of Agriculture at the time, and even now, can go in and say, that's false. They don't have to prove that anyone's relied on it.
Okay, so when I started out the questioning, I asked you if there were different elements for different plaintiffs, and you said no, but now you're, well, and you can modify, because I led you through a little thing.
No.
You said no, they're different. There were not different elements for different plaintiffs under 100.18 okay. cause of action. Are you now modifying your answer a bit?
In light of your questioning in that respect, yes. And here's the reason why I'm modifying it, because in 1980, this statute was modified to allow the first sentence in section B2 under 11B2, which gives a person the right, individual right, to bring an action under the statute and get his pecuniary loss and attorney fees. But the key word to me in that section is because. It has to be because of a violation. So that's where I say this reliance business comes in. If you can't show that you're damaged because of the violation, you have no case. And because, to me, I don't want to sound like President Clinton defining the word it, but because I think has some very simple definitions. It means on account of, in consequence of, by reason of, as a result of. That's what the word because means.
Or does it mean a cause of? I mean, does it get back to, is it a cause or a... Is your definition of because the cause or a cause?
It can be a cause. There can be other factors. Mr. Novell could have bought the house because he liked the roof, because he liked the grass, because he liked, you know, the neighborhood. A cause of his buying the house, he claims, was the statement about the basement. So I think that it doesn't have to be the sole cause. It can be a cause, a substantial factor. But it has to be a cause. And there has to be, to me, unless I'm way out in left field, a cause should be should encompass the fact that you rely on something. How can it be a cause if you don't rely on it? I just simply don't understand it.
Counsel, may I ask a quick question? In the purchase documents, did the buyer make the offer or the closing contingent upon having a home inspection?
Yes.
And here, they exercised that right. They had an inspection.
Yes.
And the inspector came back and said, look, you should hire somebody because there are problems here with the basement wall, and I think you've got some leaking problems, and I recommend you get a foundation specialist to investigate this further, right?
Correct.
And instead of doing that, they went ahead and closed on the transaction. True?
True.
So then the trial court judge said, you know what? You can't go ahead, close, knowing in fact that there's something wrong here, and then claim that you relied upon someone else in that closing when you have that information and you could have followed up and you chose not to.
That's exactly what the trial court and the Court of Appeals held.
Under the second element of 118, it seems to me that the assertion that the seller's making must not only be deceptive or misleading, but it must cause the listener to believe something other than, in fact, what is true. And, in fact, what was true was that that person had an inspector who told him, look further, there's a problem here, right?
Absolutely.
So it's not only the third element of material inducement, but also the second element that would be subject to question here.
Correct.
I just wanted to clarify that in my mind.
That's a good point. You are correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So is your position that you can't have reasonable reliance if you're advised in the report that you should get further inspection because there seems to be a problem? or might be a problem.
That's my position.
Hence the rule of law, really, that you want out of this case.
Right. That was Judge Gooley's position and the Court of Appeals position.
Okay.
And I see my red light is on here.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Us.
May it please the court, my name is Rudy Kuss, and I'm here to represent plaintiff Chad Novell. I'm going to take somewhat of a different tact here. I'm going to say what I agree with Mr. Welsenbach on right off the top of my hat. He said in his opening, he said that the trial court held as a matter of law there was no reasonable reliance. I agree with that. He also said the Court of Appeals held that reasonable reliance is not an element. I agree with that as well. I appealed the trial court's decision on the basis that reasonable reliance is not an element of 100.18. Mr. Welsenbach petitioned this court for review based on the idea that reasonable reliance is an element of 100.18. So that's what we're here for today. There have been a number of briefs written by this court's amici, which talk about matters such as cause, talk about matters such as public policy and puffery and issues like that, and that's not what we're here about today. What we're here about today is whether reasonable reliance is an element of Wisconsin Statute 100.18, and I appreciate...
Counsel, let me interrupt you right at that point. Doesn't the Court of Appeals do a bit of a dance in regard to 100.18 and justifiable reliance? They seem to say, okay, it's not a statutory element, but then they seem to say that there are instances where indeed it could be considered an element. Those instances where, as a matter of law, there can be a determination. Now, when I look at the Court of Appeals decision, you've got six claims. They uphold the dismissal of five of those claims. In four of the five, they specifically say they're relying as a matter of law on this idea of justifiable reliance to throw the matter out, the claim out, as did the trial court. In regard to strict responsibility, they don't say it specifically. They don't talk specifically about matter of law, but they say strict responsibility is basically the same kind of claim as intentional misrepresentation. So you could read it as saying they've done it there also. Now, if on five other claims they're making determinations as a matter of law, why isn't it appropriate to make the determination on 118 as a matter of law?
The answer, Justice Crooks, is that Wisconsin Statute 100.18 is a distinct cause of action, which has been held by this Court of Appeals repeatedly. Kalin versus Armstrong comes to mind. And as Justice Bradley pointed out, 100.18's origins are not a misrepresentation cause of action. It's something that the Department of Justice or the Department of Agriculture goes out and gets an injunction to prevent false advertising. The only reason it became a cause of action is because whatever department was in charge of enforcing it didn't have the resources to do it. We have a specific history, a history in the state of 100.18 not being enforced, and the state saying that a private attorney general statute is needed. We need to encourage private individuals through reasonable attorney's fees to deter this kind of action.
Well, what do you think the Court of Appeals was getting at, not only in this case, but in the Malczewski case, where they're saying it's not a statutory element, but maybe it should be in those situations where the issue can be resolved as a matter of law. What do you think they were getting at?
In that regard, Justice Crooks, I found the Novell decision very helpful to clarify Judge Fine's footnote. Judge Fine, in the Malczewski decision, said that after saying that it's not an element of 100.18, he says there are undoubtedly some circumstances where reasonable reliance should be an element. Well, that's not the law, because either something is an element or it isn't. So Judge Wiedemeyer helpfully points out that it's something that may be considered by a jury in determining whether the purchaser in fact relied on the seller's representation, but it is not a statutory element. Whether we're talking about substantial factor, whether we're talking about proximate cause, whether we're talking about public policy factors, or whether we're talking about justifiable reliance, it's all stirred up in the same pot. It all goes to the jury's consideration of whether the violation of 100.18 caused the loss.
Could I ask counsel, the Attorney General can go after false representation, but let's say I was out there as an attorney, didn't have anything to do someday, so I could not go out after, if I see some false representations, I couldn't go out after them myself. There has to be an injury to me before I could do that, is that right?
You mean as someone enforcing the statute on behalf of the Agriculture Department? Well, no, I believe as an enforcement officer, you could enforce this statute. You have the power to go out and get an injunction against false advertising. If someone is making an advertisement saying if you buy a certain driver made by TaylorMade, you can hit the ball like Tiger Woods, I think that the state has that power.
Well, I mean, the state, but I mean, okay, yeah, I can't just go and say, I don't play golf. I mean, if there's an advertisement like that, I couldn't just go out and do it as a private citizen, could I?
Well, you would have to prove that you relied on that advertisement. So if I'm just driving around and
I have to have an injury first.
Right. Yes, you would actually have to have relied on that advertisement. Actually believe that even though you have a 36 handicap, when you buy this driver, you're going to go out and hit like Tiger Woods, and you would actually have to make the purchase.
So I'd have to rely on it, wouldn't I?
Yes. Reliance is the same thing as causation. The question before the court has to do with reasonable reliance, whether it was reasonable for that person to rely on the advertisement. But the fact that this court in K&S Tool held that reasonable reliance is not an element, it doesn't mean that it's open season. There are certainly breaks on 100.18 liability. Causation sometimes is a matter of law. There are some times when the evidence is so clear that it can't be said that a false advertisement caused a loss. There's issues of credibility. The Rico versus Riva Court of Appeals decision talked about credibility, and it said that there are some circumstances where testimony is incredible as a matter of law.
Mr. Post, under your logic for your claim, if your client would have gone out and had a foundation specialist go to the home, and then report back to them, serious problems here, basement's leaky, bad walls, bad foundation, and they still went ahead and purchased the home, there would still be liability under 118. Because so long as somewhere along the line the seller says it's okay, even if you have other knowledge or should have other knowledge, the claim still survives. True?
I'm not sure you understand. I can see why you would think that way, Justice Siegler. I don't think you understand my client's position, though. My client's position is that he was told that the basement wouldn't leak, and the question is how any inspector would be able to tell him that the basement leaked to such a degree that reliance would be something that's not credible.
Well, explain to me why your claim wouldn't survive if they had the actual knowledge. What element wouldn't be met then under 118?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Your
Honor. Okay. If they went out and had the foundation specialist come back and say, leaky basement, it's bad news, whatever it is your clients found out later, if they had that and still closed, they would still have a claim under your logic for 118, true?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, Your Honor. I don't know that it's in the record what a foundation expert would have seen, which would have been any different than what a home inspector could have seen. A foundation expert doesn't necessarily have better eyes than the rest of us. And the comments that were made in this actual home inspection, not the letter that was written after the fact, but the actual home inspection, say things that are present in every home inspection report that I've seen over the past 2.5 years. They
what
say
is that?
There's mention made of moisture stains. There's mentions of stains in the basement. And very rarely do I see an inspection report that says nothing about stains and says nothing about cracks. They're ubiquitous to basements in southeast Wisconsin. I turned to page 82 of Mr. Welsenbach's initial brief. It talks about moisture locations, southern half, water stains present to southwest corner, moisture meter readings. And it says that it's recommended that the exterior downspouts be extended, proper grading, and an extension of the sump pump piping. This is the area of the basement where the sump pump was, and the record indicates that, in fact, Mr. Milascio provided my client with extensions after the fact. But based on this home inspection, especially since the home inspector marked it as marginal and not defective, we can't say that it's incredible for Mr. Novell to believe that this basement wouldn't leak, especially in light of receiving a real estate condition report under Chapter 709, in which the whole purpose of those reports is to put the burden on the seller to make truthful representations about what they know of their property, but also the statements at the home inspection in which Mr. Milascio said straight out, I have never had water in my basement. I believe there's a reference in the Realtors Association's amicus brief about the purposes of these inspection contingencies. Well, I would contend that the seller interfered with the inspection contingency himself by making a statement like that after the home inspector said, here are some moisture stains. Have you ever had water in the basement? This is a completely different situation from what we saw in, for instance, Lambert versus Hine, where the seller said in her real estate condition report, I am aware of defects. Or in Malzewski, in which there is a real estate condition report in which the seller said, I am aware of defects.
Mr. Kuss, let me ask you a question. I'm trying to hone in on Mr. Welsenbach's argument with respect to the other claims that were dismissed by the circuit court. And I'm looking at the Court of Appeals opinion, and there's breach of contract warranty, there's intentional misrepresentation, and there's negligent misrepresentation, strict responsibility misrepresentation, misrepresentation. Then you have the false advertising statute. Now, when I look at the statute, it appears that the focus of the statute is on the behavior of the party doing the advertising. When I look at the other types of violations, it seems to encompass broader than that. Now, I guess my question, and I was going to ask Mr. Welsenbach the same thing, except his red light came on. My question is really, given the focus of the statute, did the legislature intend to do something different with this cause of action than was traditionally handled in common law causes of actions that existed prior to the creation of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, but they did it in a roundabout way, again recognizing that this statute is generations older than its private causes of action. What the legislature did is it took a public enforcement statute against false advertising, and it created a private remedy. In doing so, by its very language, it's different than common law intentional misrepresentation, common law strict liability, negligent misrepresentation. And the standard is cause. And we know that the legislature knew about the word reasonable because they put it in the statute when referring to the attorney's fees, but there's no statement in the plain language of the statute that says justifiably rely, reasonably rely,
And to follow up on Justice Ziegler's question, let's assume they would have found out before purchasing that we have a leaky basement, that they had taken the steps, and they purchased the premises anyway, then would the misrepresentation be a cause?
Would the misrepresentation...
A cause for the damages, because they already know they didn't buy it. They bought the premises knowing that they had a leaky basement.
No, Your Honor. No, because if Mr. Novell receives a condition report that says, I am not aware of any seepage in my basement, and he goes downstairs and see that there's water leaking into the basement, he did not. The real estate condition report under those circumstances wouldn't have caused him to suffer a loss. He wouldn't have relied on it. And I would compare it to an example that's used in the Merchants Federation brief. They talk about whether there'd be a cause of action under the statute if a customer sees an advertisement in a store that says fresh bread sold daily and anyone who isn't blind can see that it's moldy. Well, in those circumstances, there wouldn't be a cause of action under 100.18 because the advertisement didn't cause the consumer to purchase the bread. They could see with their own eyes that it was moldy. They didn't believe it. They didn't rely on it. They purchased it for whatever reason.
And let me press you one last question following Mr. Welsenbach's point. And I understand there's a disagreement here about whether you can decide this is a matter of law versus a question of fact. But do you at least acknowledge, as a question of fact, his point that, okay, in the wake of an inspection here, and given the knowledge that, you know, there may or may not be problems here, you didn't go further and hire a contractor to do the further steps, that there's a rational argument that could be made that, well, then your purchase was not caused by that misrepresentation.
Your Honor, I would agree to the extent that that's an argument that can be made to the jury, just like K&S Tool says.
You just disagree that it can be done as a matter of law?
Under the circumstances of this case, it cannot be done as a matter of law. And paragraph 13 of the Court of Appeals case, the Court of Appeals, in contrast to all the other causes of action, says, here there is evidence presented from which a jury could conclude that the Malachios made an untrue misrepresentation which caused Novell to suffer a pecuniary loss. That's what they said about the 100.18 cause of action. The Court of Appeals is the error-correcting court. It's their job to review trial court error. And they, based on the state of the law, at that time, the K&S appeals decision, the Malczewski appeals decision said, no, this is a question for the jury. And it's this court's role to set the public policy of the state. And I think this court has already spoken in K&S Tool and that it shouldn't retreat from that holding now, that 100.18 is a distinct cause of action with distinct elements. And the difference is 100.18 speaks of cause, material inducement, and significant factors, while if you look at the jury instruction 2401, there's a couple of paragraphs in there about justifiable reliance, and they're just completely different causes of action.
Let me just clarifying. I think you've said this. One, if the buyer knows there's a misrepresentation, the buyer can't win as a matter of law. So if the buyer knows that that basement leaks like a sieve, goes ahead, looks at that misrepresentation, buys it, and now complains, that buyer is out, right?
Okay. That's correct, Your Honor. As I said, if Mr. Novell would have gone downstairs and seen a leaky basement, seen water leaking, absolutely not.
He may have known because every neighbor in the street told him they see the house float away every spring. I mean, there are lots of ways he would know without having to see it. Okay. Here you have an inspection, right?
Yes.
Now, does this report alert the buyer that there's a leaky basement problem?
Your Honor, I believe that's a question of fact for the jury under the circumstances. There are statements made about stains in the basement, the southwest corner, and the jury would hear that's the area where the sump pump is. And there's talk about moisture meter readings. I'm not sure whether it's in the record where those moisture meter readings were taken, but this is something to determine whether there's moisture inside the block walls, not to determine whether there's actual active seepage. And there are recommendations made for changing, making some grading and some downspout improvements.
So here your position is that the inspection did not alert. I'm sorry. Here your position is the question whether the inspection alerted the buyer to do something more or alerted the buyer regarding the basement was a question of fact.
Whether it alerted him in fact is a question of fact.
Okay.
Whether it alerted, should have alerted him, well, that's
a question of fact.
But, well, in normal circumstances, but here it is, in all fairness, the law of the case. But in general, in these types of cases.
Depending on how we hold the law, what we hold of the law and reliance.
Under 100.18, it's a question of fact.
Counsel, I'm sorry, Chief, go ahead.
If the home buyer is alerted, suppose there was something in here that definitely alerted him to to the water, and he doesn't go out and get further inspection by someone else who will delve deeper, can he sue?
Yes, Your Honor, for a couple of different reasons. Number one, there is no duty in the state to investigate representations that are not obviously false. That's even a part of the common law, which is, as we have seen, somewhat narrower than Wisconsin Statute 100.18. Mr. Novell read the report, saw the moisture stains pointed out to him in the basement by his inspector, but afterwards, Mr. Milagros told him, I've never had water in my basement. Okay. Is that statement one that's obviously false, especially in an environment where the home inspector is pointing out different contributing factors that could make a wall wet, such as the presence of a sump crock and improper grading? Again, moisture is a completely different issue than actual active seepage in the basement. Secondly, under the contract that Mr. Novell signed, he was only allowed to make modifications to the contract or to get out of the contract if the home inspector told him about defects. Now, the home inspector says a lot of things here about marginal issues and not strictly related to the basement either. There are about two pages of items here which the home inspector found marginal.
What page are you at?
I'm at page 87 and 88 of Mr. Welsenbach's brief. But he did not, going back to page 82, 82, yeah. Page 82, he didn't mark anything about the basement defective. And the inspection contingency said that this offer is contingent on a home inspection that discloses no defects.
Well, what about it says on 87, foundation, block cracked with displacement, stair step cracks, consideration for further evaluation by foundation specialist. It's at the bottom of 87. Does that have anything to do with the water in the basement?
No, because not all cracks leak, and I don't think there's been any allegation here that the cracks have caused leaks. Mr. Weber's report says that there's a problem with the drain tile system. And Mr. Novell couldn't have gotten out of this contract based on the home inspection. There are no defects identified. And his inspection contingency said, you can get out of this contract if the home, you may be able to get out of this contract if the home inspector notes defects.
Thank you. Justice Bradley?
The jury instruction with regard to 100.18 sets forth a test on the third element, this causation. And the test it sets forth is, it says, the test is whether the plaintiff would have acted in its absence, that is, in the absence of the misrepresentation. Do you believe that's a correct statement of the test? Are you in accord with that or not?
Yes, I agree with that statement. I mean, it's a subjective test. It's whether the plaintiff would have acted but for the statement. It's causation.
But for is different than, I may be wrong, but for sounds to me like a the cause rather than a cause, the way that you stated it. Think I'm wrong? That's okay if I'm wrong. Just tell me. I mean, in other words, the test is whether would have acted in its absence.
I still think that the jury instruction supports a cause, because there are, if any number of factors would have changed, that could have caused Mr. Novell not to buy this house. I mean, but, yeah, maybe in retrospect, looking at this, maybe I didn't write this, but maybe it isn't worded the best to cover the a cause standard that has long been a part of causation law.
There's no question in this case that the plaintiff is part of the public. Is there? No, nobody's
no,
fighting that.
It's never been raised whether he was a part of the public, and under your decision in K&S Tool, that's a question of fact anyway. So.
Okay.
Are there any further questions from the court?
No, I noticed economic loss doctrine wasn't referenced anywhere.
It would have resulted in a less voluminous record, that's for sure. But
okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
We can probably bring it in.
Let me just start my rebuttal by answering Justice Butler's question, and the question was, did the statute intend to do something different than common law? That's my understanding of your question, Justice. Mr. Kuss said yes. I say no. And here's why I say no. We looked back at the legislative history here starting in 1913, and what really happened here, and I'm basing this on what I read in the Marquette Law Review article that has been referenced in some of these briefs. Apparently in the 60s and maybe into the 70s, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Justice either didn't have the manpower or the incentive or whatever you want to call it to enforce these actions. So in 1970, it allowed the private party to get pecuniary damages, twice the amount of pecuniary damages for violation of an injunction. And then in 1980, it added on this private cause of action. Now, the best discussion I've seen of this statutory history and statutory construction is in the amicus brief filed by Mr. Armstrong on behalf of the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. And he talks about the legislative intent, et cetera, statutory construction starting at page 9. And I think what he says, and I'll give him full credit for that, is that if the statute changes the common law, there must be a clear expression by the legislature of that in the statute. There is no such expression in this statute.
Mr. Welsenbach, let me focus on what my question was honing in on, because I understand your response really kind of honed in on a couple of the changes in allowing a private party to get damages as well as a private cause of action. But it seems to me when I read the statute and the history of the statute that the purpose of the statute was to try to keep people from misleading the public in an advertising setting. That was the focus of the statute. So it seems to be a consumer protection type statute where the state is actually invoking its police powers to go in and try to stop this stuff from happening. And as part of the growth of that statute, different causes of actions were added to beef it up. But if the focus of the statute is to try, it seems to me the focus on the statute is on the, quote, wrongdoer, as opposed to the focus of the statute being on, quote, the person who was harmed. That seems to be the little bit of the twist on the statute versus common law, the common law approach. Now, I understand, and that's the reason why I pressed the question to Mr. Kuss, I understand that in that process, you still can't recover if you have not been harmed, or if there is no causation. Causation is an element of this. But I'm just focusing in on what the statute was trying to get at. And it seems to me, and maybe I'm, and if you disagree, tell me, but it seems to me that this statute is a consumer protection statute designed to stop people from doing this to others.
Absolutely. That's the purpose back in 1913. It's been expanded. And all I'm saying is, though, that in the private cause of action, the common law is not to be disregarded, that if the legislature wanted to disregard the common law elements, it would have done so. What the statute does, it gives you extra rights. It gives you the attorney fees, and the economic loss doctrine doesn't apply. And as Mr. Kuss just stated, quote, reliance is the same thing as causation. So therefore, reliance is in the picture here. The question is, does it have to be reasonable reliance or unreasonable? Mr. Kuss says, and I'm not picking on Mr. Kuss, actually it's probably Mr. Stevens who came up with the idea, but they say at their brief on page 17, and listen to this, moreover, the enforceability of section 118 should not depend on whether the victim acted reasonably. Now, I ask you in all seriousness, does that make any sense that you can just act unreasonably and have the right to sue? It makes no sense. Can there be unreasonable reliance giving you the right to collect money and attorney fees? No, it doesn't make sense. So therefore, I say,
here's the issue. Okay. And I know what the decision of the trial court was. The question is, if you know that the misrepresentation is false, you can't rely on it and sue. I mean, we all agree on that. Mr. Kuss does, too.
True.
You're given a representation that the basement doesn't leak. Your eyes show a stain. Your eyes show relatively fresh paint. The inspector comes through and says what tells you what you see and says, hey, it could be caused by any number of things. And it says maybe you want to look at the foundation. You rely on that at the bottom of page 87. Now, how far does the home buyer have to go? You've got a representation. This guy says, I've lived here, was it 9 years?
9 years.
Yeah. No, no leakage.
Right.
No leakage. It's moisture. I don't deny that. There's an explanation for that. I've lived here 9 years, no leakage. Nothing in the report says there is heavy leakage. Can I go ahead and buy this house, and then when it leaks like a sieve the next day, can I sue, in your opinion?
No.
So what I, as a buyer, it's I'm at risk. I have to check everything out. So when I buy a house, according to you, I've got to not only have this residential inspector, I've got to have, if I notice a stain on the basement, a foundation expert come in. If I notice a stain on the ceiling of the upstairs bedroom, I have to have a roof guy come in. If I notice a slight buckle in a floor, I have to have somebody come in to check that. If there's a crack on the ground floor level near the window, my house has a lot of them, I have to get somebody in who's going to check the foundation and the whole structure of the house to see whether or not it's really going to shift into Lake Monona. And that's all of mine, and I can't rely on the seller saying, that crack has been there forever, it hasn't changed, there's occasional moisture, but it doesn't leak like a sieve. I had some water damage when the roof was, when a shingle came off the roof, that was repaired. It does not leak now. I can't rely on any of that. That's how I hear your case.
No, here's what I'm saying. I'm saying for this case, when you elect to have a home inspector come in, he elected to do that.
Right.
The home inspector came in and said, I see water stains present. I have high moisture meter readings. I am telling you, Mr. Novell, get a basement specialist to look at this basement.
You're relying on page 87?
That's on page 87. Page 88 says water stains and high moisture meter readings.
All right, well, these my example I gave you, you would say I can't rely on the seller. I've got to go and check it all out.
You don't have to. But when,
I can't sue.
But you can't.
If I don't check it out and I buy the house anyway, I'm stuck. When it leaks from the roof, it leaks from the sides, and it leaks from the basement. Because I've been warned.
If it's known to you that these things, in fact, are true, and you
the
buy
exact
it?
Same fact situation as you have here.
No.
The seller says no leakage.
Right.
The report says, and you can see it, there are stains and there's moisture. It explains that, mm-hmm. and being very cautious, this man says you might want to. It says marginal. It says consideration for further evaluation by foundation specialist. Consideration for evaluation by foundation specialist. It doesn't say you better do this because there's moisture. You ought to consider it. If I were writing this report, I'd put that everywhere. That takes gets me off the hook for liability.
Well, that all may be true. That's not an issue of fact here. The trial court has held it was unreasonable reliance. Now, if we don't like that, if the plaintiff doesn't like that decision, that should have been the subject of the issue before this court.
But you agree that it's not reasonable if you should have investigated further. You cited the Federation brief, and I think that's their position.
I'm sorry.
You cited the Federation brief. That's their position, I think. If you're on an alert, you should investigate further, not sue. Your position?
I would think that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I'm trying to figure out, that's your position.
Right.
Tina, I'm sorry. If I ask just for a clarification, please. It sounds to me like you were suggesting that with regard to the marginal summary,
that with regard to the basement, which is page 12 of 12 of the report, that it says evaluation by foundation specialist. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't see that under basement. I see it when you're talking about the cracks in the foundation, the stair-step cracks considered for further evaluation by foundation expert, and when you're considering the differential movement, which mm-hmm. is on page 11 of 12, but it says consider for evaluation by a foundation expert. But I may be missing something, but when you're dealing with a basement, it says recommended extending exterior downspouts, proper grading, extended sump pump piping to divert water away from foundation, but doesn't have it there. Doesn't have anything about getting a foundation expert to address water problems. Now, does that appear someplace else? Am I missing something?
There's page 81 under the heading of structure, and mm-hmm. I think that's the same as the conclusion on page 87. I mean, structure.
Well, structure is what? Foundation block here. It
right,
says cracked with displacement, stair steps. That's what I referred to on page 11 of 12.
Right, that's,
well, that's foundation block, because that's for that. And then the differential movement. Those are both on page 11 of the 12-page report. The basement is on page 12 and doesn't say anything about it. It's just a fact that I want clarified.
In other words, cracks in the basement, are they connected with the water? That's really the issue.
Well,
or the question.
I think you're asking, is the foundation the same as the basement? The foundation is the same as the basement. The foundation structure. The structure of the basement is the foundation, and he found clearly there were some measurements there that showed the differential movement.
Yeah, that's on page 11.
Right, I mean, that's the basement.
I know it's, I mean, you know,
yeah.
I know steps leading to the basement are steps leading to the basement.
No, it's not. It's not.
Yeah.
Your Honor, it's stair step cracks are not steps, it's cracks in the stairs. They're cracks in the wall. In the form of...
Okay, get that. I apologize.
It looked like steps. So when he talks about foundation, he's talking about the basement foundation.
And are these the cracks and the differential movement? Is that related to the water?
That's what I don't understand, because it's not set forth on that page that deals with water, stains, and basement. It's set forth on a different page. Just a factual.
It may be. It may not be. I don't know. I don't even know if there was water in this basement ever anyway. So I don't know what the cause of it is.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. That concludes our hearing in another case. We seem to have a run on 100.18 cases. 05-AP-2852 Novell versus Iglesio, and we appreciate both Mr. Welsenbeck and Mr. Kuss in their arguments today, and we terminate our hearing in 05-AP-2852, Novell versus Iglesio. We'll take a few moments recess so the students may leave and other students may enter.